Hi, it's All in the Mind. I'm Lynne Malcolm. Today, acquired brain injury, from small blows to the head to a traumatic event that can change the essence of who you are.
We need to take acquired brain injury seriously, including mild brain injury, especially if it's a repeated brain injury. In the past, people would say, well, you know, I just got my bell rung or it was no big deal. But we're understanding now more and more that it can be a big deal.
Dr. Sandeep Vaishnavi.
I was one of the class of often unfortunate road users called a bicycle commuter. And on this particular morning, the 8th of February 1996, I was hit pretty much head-on by a car. Broke my leg, broke the bicycle frame in two. I sailed over the bonnet of the car, took the full force of the impact pretty much on the right side of my face next to my helmet, and then sailed over the first car and landed on a second car that was parked.
Fortunately or unfortunately, I can pretty much remember most of what happened. Mark, my stepfather, came into my granny flat and he asked me for some tea towels. And when I turned to get the tea towels, I felt him grip me from behind and he pushed me to the floor. And I didn't even know he had a hammer, but I was pleading with him to stop, that he was hurting me.
Rebecca Sciroli, whose brain injury was the result of an horrific violent attack. And before her, Nick Rushworth, Executive Officer of Brain Injury Australia, which represents the more than 700,000 Australians with a brain injury.
While we have great research into the physical, cognitive and behavioural aspects of the disability and what it means, there is still all that really messy and complex psychosocial stuff that is to do with the lifelong struggle that many of my constituents experience in coming to terms with the new person that they are.
More from Nick Rushworth and Rebecca Sciroli later.
Traumatic brain injury is basically where there is some impact to the brain. And after that impact on the brain, the person who's suffering from it has some dazing or confusion. And when we talk about acquired brain injury, there's really a gamut from mild to more severe. The more common acquired brain injury is a mild traumatic brain injury or a concussion, and that's about 70 to maybe even 80% of acquired brain injuries.
Dr. Sandeep Vaishnavi is a neuropsychiatrist at Duke University Medical Center and co-author with Dr. Vani Rao of The Traumatized Brain. In the United States, he says, there's 1.5 to 2 million acquired brain injuries per year, and 5 to 6 million people are on disability services due to their injury. Mild brain injuries mostly occur during contact sports, falls, and car accidents. They aren't necessarily caused by a big impact to the head. Sometimes, if the head is jolted back and forth in the skull, fibres within the brain are stretched. Dr. Vaishnavi believes that acquired or traumatic brain injury is a silent epidemic.
Mostly because there are so many acquired brain injuries that never actually get to the point where there's medical attention. So the issue here is that if you have 70% of acquired brain injuries that people kind of minimize and say, well, you know, it's just a concussion. Well, the thing is that repetitive concussions like that may actually end up having consequences to the brain. That's really a very hot topic right now, especially with American football, for example, the National Football League in the United States. There have been studies with football players that have indicated that people who have repetitive concussions or mild brain injuries, over time it adds up, or it can add up, and it can cause mood changes, behavioral changes, and memory and attention changes, and even in some people be associated with a form of dementia. Essentially, what we're talking about is the buildup of a certain protein called tau. So we do see that in Alzheimer's disease, for example, and so forth. But there seems to be a particular pathological signature for this chronic traumatic encephalopathy. And so this is something which is relatively new. It's still controversial to some degree in the sense that we don't know if these studies that are done oftentimes in professional American football players, if they are relevant to the rest of the population or not. But in clinic, I certainly see that people can have long-term pathological consequences in the brain tissue itself. The other reason that I call it a silent epidemic is that even in the more moderate to severe brain injuries, the problem is that the acute issue is usually well treated in the hospital. But the problem is the long-term consequences of acquired brain injury. And those long-term consequences oftentimes are neuropsychiatric consequences. And by that, I mean mood changes, behavioral changes, and cognitive changes. And those symptoms are often not dealt with very well or not dealt with at all. And that's also part of the silent epidemic.
So how often would you need to have a brain injury or some knock to the head to really end up with these sorts of problems?
Well, so that's a good question, because there's a lot of variability with this, and we don't really fully understand why that is. It could partly be related to what is the resilience of that brain. Are there other factors, like, for example, were there mood problems or behavioral problems or cognitive problems even before the brain injury to some extent, and then maybe they got worsened or exacerbated by the brain injury? But the main point here is we need to take it seriously. So if there is a brain injury, even if it's a mild brain injury, especially if there are multiple mild brain injuries, or if there's even a solitary, moderate, or severe brain injury, we have to be really watchful for the long-term consequences.
Do these brain injury symptoms appear differently in children than adults?
They may, actually. So I'll give you an example. So in the sports context, if their kids are playing sports in school and they really, really want to compete, they want to be on the team, we sometimes see kids getting concussions and they don't attend as much to their symptoms as adults do. Or it could be that kids are just having some less symptoms, actually, with mild injury than adults. So there is no good age to get a brain injury, though, is the bottom line.
So is the risk enough that parents should consider taking their children out of contact sports?
Well, that's the very controversial issue right now. I think that what I would advocate for is to take any kind of head injury, brain injury seriously and to minimize the risk of that. That doesn't mean that, you know, we shouldn't play sports at all, because there's benefit with sports, physical benefit as well as mental, emotional, and developmental benefit. So it is good to do sports, but personally, like in my case, I have two boys, and I would not put them into American football for that reason until maybe they're older, they're more stable, and they're able to acknowledge and understand these risks and to avoid the risks as much as possible.
Sandeep Vaishnavi says that whether the brain injury is mild, moderate, or severe, it's often the neuropsychiatric symptoms which most deeply affect the patient and their family.
There are mood symptoms, there are behavioral symptoms, and there are cognitive symptoms. So in the mood category, we see a lot of depression in patients with brain injury. Maybe even 50% of patients can have clinical symptoms of depression. And we think at least part of it is due to brain circuitry being affected by the injury. So we do know that there are certain circuits that basically allow us to regulate our moods so that we don't get depressed. And those circuits can be affected by the impact of the injury. One can also see other mood problems, such as something called pseudobulbar affect, or PBA, where people have trouble controlling their emotional expression. So they may have trouble with crying, or they may have trouble with laughing, and the crying and laughing may be disproportionate to the stimulus. So in other words, they're crying excessively for something which is not that sad. It's not something that should make them that sad, but they cry excessively. That's also directly related to disruption of certain circuits in the brain because of the brain injury. We can see mania sometimes, where people actually become very energetic excessively and not wanting to sleep and talking very fast and thinking very fast. So that's the mood component. The behavioral component is really more in terms of getting agitated, being aggressive, personality changes. Again, that we think is related to damage to certain circuits of the brain, especially in the frontal lobes. And then finally, the cognitive symptoms that we see, neuropsychiatric symptoms, are related to problems with attention and focus, problems with memory, problems with processing quickly, trouble with multitasking, those kinds of things. So there's a wide gamut of neuropsychiatric symptoms.
Dr. Sandeep Vaishnavi. He says there are a range of effective therapies used for people with brain injury. Because of the brain's plasticity, intensive cognitive brain training programs can be very helpful. Medication can be effective for some symptoms, and meditation and yoga can help with anxiety and mood. Rebecca Sciroli has been living with brain injury for over 17 years. She was a practicing artist and had just finished her Bachelor of Visual Arts at university when she was violently attacked by her stepfather with a hammer.
Mark, my stepfather, came into my granny flat and he asked me for some tea towels. And when I turned to get the tea towels, I felt him grip me from behind. And he pushed me to the floor. And I didn't even know he had a hammer, but I was pleading with him to stop that he was hurting me. And the only thing he said during the assault was, "It's the only way." At the time, I couldn't understand why, especially with such violence, he would try to end my life and then he went into the house and tried to attack my mother and my sister. And when the police arrived, he was trying to slit his own wrists with a machete.
Mm. So what are your first memories after you were taken to hospital?
I had a lot of hallucinations, and I remember laying in the bed and beating my arm plasters on the sides of the beds. And the nurses just said, "Oh, she's just being behavioural." They didn't really understand that I was trying to tell them that I thought Mark was coming through the air conditioning duct to attack me again.
Mm. So you were obviously very disturbed.
Yeah, I was still very scared.
What do you understand about the actual damage that was caused in your brain?
Well, because most of the skull was smashed on the right side of my brain, it's done most of an effect in paralysis on my left side of my body. And because I still have small fragments of my skull embedded in the surface of my brain, and I have a lot of scarring that causes me to now have epileptic seizures.
And you had one quite recently, didn't you?
Yes. I had 2 years before the last bout of seizures, and then last year I've had a couple, and yesterday I had another one.
So how are you feeling today?
I'm quite tired. A seizure's like running a marathon because your whole body goes stiff and spasms.
After the injury, you were in the brain recovery unit for a period of 5 months. What did the therapy involve?
The brain injury rehabilitation unit was very comprehensive in that they worked on my body, but also we had cognitive therapy. We used to play games and do quizzes and try and exercise our brains and also practice socializing and speaking, and I learned how to eat again and how to walk relatively as properly as I can.
And did you experience any other symptoms? You had cognitive difficulties? Did you have mood difficulties as well? Any depression or changes in your personality?
Yes, I think in the early days, I suffered a fair amount of depression because I had a lot of trouble adjusting to the new Rebecca and to realise that I did still have abilities and there were things that I could learn and do. Yeah, the depression was quite scary.
And how have you coped with that?
I did a lot of art therapy on myself. While I was in the hospital, one of my friends came in with a sketchbook and I started to keep a bit of a visual journal of how I was feeling and sort of work through those feelings in a visual way.
How would you describe the way you are now, physically and mentally?
Physically, I'm as, I guess, normal, for want of a better word, as I can be. I'm walking around as best I can, although I get quite tired because of the spasticity in my left leg. And mood-wise, I'm probably much more motivated than I've ever been, apart from when I was motivated to learn to walk.
When Rebecca Sciroli was in the brain injury unit, most of the other patients there were young men who'd been in motor vehicle accidents.
In the beginning days, I was almost embarrassed to tell people that a member of my own family had assaulted me and caused my brain injury, and especially because I had no reason why. But I think as I got better and left the brain injury unit, the more I've told other women and other people about being a victim of domestic violence or family violence, the more it's allowed other people to open up to me about their own situations.
So what's your opinion about the way the public perceives those with brain injury?
Well, I know during my own recovery, I had the problem in that my friends kind of perceived that I wasn't the same person and that I would need things to be explained to me. They just took for granted that my cognitive ability was less. And in the general public, I had the problem that I wanted to volunteer to teach an art group, but because of my spasticity, I wasn't allowed because the director of the group said, no, what if somebody knocks you over or your balance isn't so good? So I think that if we had a more positive understanding of brain injury and the abilities that are still there with a brain injury, people would be much more able to contribute to society.
Are you a different person now, do you think?
I was always a very caring person and I always wanted to help others. And I think that part of me has probably become a bit stronger than it was before. And I think I'm probably not as worried about myself as much as I used to be and about achieving outside goals. The goal's really far more to be the best me that I can be in all the ways that I can. And I'm really inspired to help other people with brain injury to achieve an understanding of what their new abilities are and to learn that they are still worthwhile human beings and they can do a lot with their life.
So have you had contact with your stepfather since, and how do you feel about him?
I haven't had any contact with Mark yet, but I would like to see him because in myself I feel I don't have any negative feelings towards him. And I now see what he did to me as just a bad decision. I don't think he ever meant to hurt me.
Do you think he was in his right mind?
I don't think so. He wasn't thinking at all, I think. He came up with this strange idea and then just followed it through without thinking what he was doing. Mm. Yeah.
Hard to understand.
Very hard, yeah.
Rebecca Sciroli is now an ambassador for the Living Life My Way campaign, part of the New South Wales Family and Community Services. And she's also an art therapist. You're with All in the Mind. I'm Lynn Malcolm. Today, we're discussing life with an acquired brain injury. Nick Rushworth is Executive Officer of Brain Injury Australia, an advocacy organisation representing the needs of people with acquired brain injury and their families and carers. He's had personal experience of a severe traumatic brain injury himself. 20 years ago, he had a serious bicycle accident on his way to work at the ABC in Sydney.
I used to live about, 2 kilometres away from where we're sitting, and would travel straight down a major road to get to work each morning at 7 o'clock thereabouts. And on this particular morning, the 8th of February 1996, I was hit pretty much head on by a car. Broke my leg, broke the bicycle frame in two. I sailed over the bonnet of the car, took the full force of the impact pretty much on the right side of my face next to my helmet. The forces were such that the car had a metal sun visor over the windscreen that tore my right ear off. I have no recollection of any of this, by the way. This is what I was told and what police reports and hospital reports identified. And then sailed over the first car and landed on a second car that was parked in a side street waiting for the lights to change.
What was your first conscious memory after that?
Look, I have absolutely crystal clear memory, bizarrely, of everything the night before. I can't remember anything about getting up that morning, about getting on the bike, nothing about the collision. And pretty much the entirety of my hospital stay has been wiped as well. So I've got some patches of memory the last couple of days at hospital, but that's about it, which I've always assumed has been the brain's wonderful defence mechanism. You can't remember the trauma itself. And like a lot of standard issue head trauma patients, I was highly aggressive, highly irritable, highly physically arousable in hospital, and needed to be both physically and pharmacologically restrained.
Nick Rushworth has made a remarkable recovery over 20 years. He's the first to admit that he's been incredibly lucky. He was very fit before the accident, and he had a number of social advantages. His father is a brain surgeon, and his mother and sister are doctors. So along with his work connections, he had powerful support throughout his rehabilitation. However, he still refers to his recovery as a marathon, not a sprint. Has he changed as a result?
It's I guess the only true measure of this are the people that knew me before my injury and after. And I think some of them would say that I'm harder to get to know, harder to get to like. I think, like a lot of people who experience a brain injury of such quality, my fuse is a little shorter. But look, I think I'm like the old Nick Rushworth, only more so. I think overall what the injury did was to take some of those pre-injury personalities and give them an enormous shove.
Now, as Executive Officer of Brain Injury Australia, one of the national disability advocacy organisations, Nick Rushworth wants to raise the levels of awareness and compassion for people with brain injury.
I, as a lobbyist, represent everyone from the shaken baby through to the old person who falls over and lands on their head. And for a lot of my colleagues, it still comes as a surprise that the leading cause of head injury, traumatic brain injury throughout the Western world isn't motor vehicle accidents or assaults, it's falls. Not because there are more drunken teenagers taking high dives off balconies at 2 a.m. on a Saturday after 45 rum and cokes. As the population ages, more old people fall over and land on their heads. And one of my missions in life, as it were, is to get the nation's trauma doctors, geriatricians, to take head injury in older people more seriously and not to confuse or conflate it with the early stages of dementia.
How would you describe the general level of awareness of brain injury in Australia?
My starting position on this is the public awareness about brain injury lags about 20 or 30 years behind that of other disabilities. The brain itself, I still think, is a kind of a final and fearful frontier for some people, and so brain injury fits into that.
So what would you like to be able to do to change that perception?
Well, I think what I would like to do is to raise the level of understanding and awareness and levels of compassion for people with a brain injury, people like Rebecca, to a level of parity with other disability types in the community. If you were to walk out onto the street here today and ask people about what Down syndrome is and means, there'll be a good, reasonable working knowledge of that disability, but it won't be the same for brain injury, I don't think. And it is the leading cause of death and disability in young people. And Australia is blessed, if you can call it that, with great longitudinal surveys of the outcome of traumatic brain injury in the young. And roughly 9 in 10 return to the care of their family. Only around half are employed 5 years post-injury. Half of all marriages involving a partner with a brain injury dissolve within 5 years of injury. The lifetime costs of care for a young person with a traumatic brain injury, around $5 million. For me, and even though I kind of relatively sailed through my injury, it is still the watershed event of my life. My life will always be divided by that day. And for a lot of my constituents, they don't have the capacity, as I think I did, to pick up their pre-injury life where they left it and continue.
Do you feel as though you've got extra hope now with the new knowledge, even over the 20 years since your accident, the new knowledge and understanding about the brain's capacity to renew, the neuroplasticity of the brain?
Oh, absolutely. And I always say that, you know, prepare to be surprised by the capacity of people to repair and recover. Not everyone is inside the bell curve. There are genuine outliers, people who will surprise you. One of the things that I hear still regularly is that in the context of a trauma unit of a major teaching hospital, some doctors will still say to family members that John or Jill will not be able to do X, Y, or Z ever again. Very, very early in the stages of recovery, within 24 hours. I think part of the unmet capacity of people to repair and recover from brain injury is to do with the receptiveness they meet in the community about the disability. And if the community was more receptive, there would be a greater capacity for the brain's plasticity to express itself. The other part of it is that, you know, if you look at the numbers of people that I represent, there are around 700,000 Australians who've got a brain injury. And that's people with daily activity limitations and participation restrictions. Only 20,000 of those people out of 820,000 are on a pension, a disability support pension. Only 2,000 out of 160,000 use disability employment services. Only 16,000 out of 300,000 use disability services. That leaves a lot of men and women in their 30s, 40s and 50s living in their pyjamas, being cared for by, more often than not, mum. So the more understanding, the more knowledge, the more compassion there is in the community to meet people with a brain injury, the greater the capacity for the expression of the kind of plasticity we are discovering.
Nick Rushworth, Executive Officer of Brain Injury Australia. And thanks to Rebecca Sciroli for bravely sharing her story with us. Head to the All in the Mind website for more information and leave a comment there too. We always love to hear from you. Today's sound engineer is Judy Rapley. I'm Lynn Malcolm. Great to have your company. Bye for now. Before we go, some news about a new ABC podcast. It's our first ever podcast for kids. It's called Short and Curly, and it takes on ethical dilemmas like whether robots could really love someone, whether chimpanzees and children should be treated the same, and whether it's okay to fight back against a bully. It's a show for 7 to 12 year olds, but Short and Curly is all about people listening together in the car on the way to sport or school or on holidays. A key to developing a critical and philosophical approach to the world is making sure conversations are not one-sided, with adults telling a child what to think. This show asks you to think, but doesn't tell you what to think. Jam-packed with popular culture, it's a fast-paced ride through some tricky and curly questions. Subscribe via the ABC app, iTunes, SoundCloud, and your favourite podcast app.